Accession number 12713, Mr. T. Temple, reel 3.
Mr. Tony Temple, reel 3. At Black Dye, Mr. Temple, and as a boy soldier in effect, did you have any leisure other than the sports facilities, etc., that you were working with or playing in?
Not a great deal, Harry. We used to have, as I say, the sports mainly was governed by the army curriculum, if you can call it that, such as hockey, football, swimming, whatever it was. But outside of that, we weren't allowed out a lot. We were allowed to go down to the village of Deepcut or Blackdown, the cinema, the local cinemas, but that would probably be it. Sometimes we would get a journey up to London, because we were very close to it. Again, we were supposed to be a conductor, you know, accompanied by a bandsman or a bugler. In effect, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but in effect, we used to go out with them and then come back on our own. It was one of those sneaky things which we had to do in order to get out. We were so much confined to camp. But so long as we were back in time for about 8 o'clock, nobody seemed to bother so much. Probably closed a blind eye to it. They knew possibly it was going on. But they sort of said, well, these guys must be having a lonely life, which it was, really. I wouldn't say a lonely so much as a sparse life. Not so much as we had very little to do outside. And a case could be made out, which was made out when we went abroad, but we'll probably come on to that later. Other than the army sports, the occasional run out to London or sometimes to Reading, normal leave, which is, you know, it's about 3 times a year, very little outside sports. From the school experience and from the army experience, we didn't need very much outside of that, because we were kept so busy, especially with the music, the band practices, which was practically every day, the church parades, which were every week, and we were always, on a Sunday especially, there was always a duty band detailed to play in church rather than the organ, because it was a garrison church. We were detailed once, I think it was about every 3 weeks, there was a two weeks, DC and I were in one set of barracks, we were in detention, and we used to take it between the two of us and transfer. It was always a ceremony of seniority on the conclusion of the church. The parades and the various regiments and the companies would assemble. And we would, we were the junior regiment at the time, and we were always last to be away. But because of the pace that the regiment used to travel at, it was about 160 an hour, 160 a minute. And the heavy infantry, such as the engineers, the Royal Artillery, the RASC, the Royal Ordnance Corps, we all had contingents in the church parades. We were always lagging behind, so they changed it round and said, right, oh, to get the way, we'll push them out first and get them out of the way, then they could carry on with their... Because it was a question of either hanging back or being overtaken, I mean, they don't like to be overtaken in the army. You know, this sort of thing just isn't done, or wasn't at the time. But we eventually won the battle to get out first and away, because of the speed that we used to travel. And it was a speed, Harry. 160 a minute, it was, you were almost running. And to try to play instruments when you're doing that, very, very difficult until you really got used to it. And the bass drummer and the heavy instruments, like the basses, not so much the trombones, they were fairly light, but they having double Bs and things like that. We used to have a hell of a job. And it was one of those things which, as I say, you become accustomed to after you've been used to it for some years. But it was, again, there's another episode which I could give later on in the programme about overtaking a guards regiment on the road. You know, it's one of those things that virtually happened. But other than the musical side, mind, we used to do a lot of education. Through, as I told before, at least every morning, without fail, the education, sometimes in the evening, we used to have to pass sit for exams, just the same as any schoolboy would. And this went on until you were 18. And I was in North China, and I was still going to school.
But was there a strong element of the regimental history running through this
Oh, yes, we used to have one particular subject you used to take was what they called Army and Empire. So you were doing geography at the same time you were doing history of the Army generally, but more importantly, you were doing history of the regiment and where they served. And when you went through that history, really good, there wasn't a place that the DNI hadn't been at some stage in the life of the regiment. And I said, this took a tremendous amount of our time off. I suppose even in the evenings, the boys always had to go into band practice. The band were finished, but we had to go into individual practice. So you were going on military business up until about 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, depending on how the individual practice went. And it was always a cacophony of sound because you were stuck in a little corner. And I was playing my little flute or piccolo, whatever I was chose to do. And somebody was about 5 yards away. He was with a clarinet doing something. There was somebody else with a trumpet here, and nobody else with a trombone. It was just a horrible sound. But you knew what you were doing. You knew what you were playing. And this, as I say, used to go until well into the evening, sometimes until 7 o'clock. So we didn't have a great deal of time for anything outside of the sphere of the military service.
You mentioned the speed of your march and playing instruments, of course. Was it, in your case, a gradual increasing of speed to the ultimate of the regimental pace?
Well, it had to be.
In the early days?
Yes, it had to be. You see, I came from the military school, which was based at small boys, and the pace was about, I would think, about as quick as the heavy infantry in the army, but with smaller paces. But when you had to try to adapt from that smaller pace to the normal pace of 27 inches, and at the same time trying to blow an instrument, at the same time trying to gallop along the road, it took some getting into. And you were allowed periods when... This was one of the practices of the band, in effect. Whilst, you should see, we had our band practice room where all the instruments were kept and music was kept. We also had, on the square to ourselves, marching practice, which we had to do almost once or twice a week. And, of course, this gradually quickened you up in the sense that you become accustomed to it. The length of pace, for my mind, was the more difficult than the speed, because I was coming from a schoolboy and going into the band, which was normal pace was 27 inches, and you're going at 160 an hour, a minute, rather than the 120 to a minute, which is the heavy infantry. It took some getting into, but you eventually got used to a bit of the continual practice you had on the square. Or sometimes we would do parades. The company regiments, the rifle regiments, would do parades, which are sometimes the bands were present, to give them the training of the marching past in slow time, quick time, and funny enough, in double time. Because our regiment march we had for each one. And the double time, of course, was keel row. And when it's funny to see regiment after company after company going past the saluting base at the double with the rifles at the tail and the band going hell for leather, as it were, playing the keel row. You know, it looked comical until you become accustomed to it. You know, it looked peculiar at the time, but we enjoyed it.
Were there any outstanding funny instances when you were doing this that you recall?
Not so much in Blackdown, because I was at the apprentice stage, as it were. You know, for a 14-year-old, you don't have much time for anything peculiar. And I can't recall anything that was struck funny. Maybe sometime later in the program, we could refer to that if I can read something.
Learning this pace and someone stumbling and the whole band piling it on top, you might say.
No, that never happened. You would get lagged behind, possibly, but somebody else was at the back of you, kicking your backside. But the position of the piccolo player at the time was at the back on the right-hand side. As I say, this is where I went. And gradually, as I say, I was lagging behind, but the band sergeant kept geeing me up until the summer. I can't recall any incident which was any serious offence at all.
Discipline for boys, again, in the situation you were in, did that vary in any way from what the older soldiers were experiencing?
No, you were still governed by the same discipline. There was no leeway in that respect. I think the leeway that you got was the severity of the punishment. Whereas if there was a misdemeanour created by a rifleman in one of the companies, or one of the bandsmen for that matter, he would probably get 14 days confined or to barracks or 7 days. We would probably get a severe ticket, first of all by the band sergeant, then the band master, then you were up in front of the company commander. And you would probably get 3 days confined to barracks, which in effect didn't mean a lot. Whilst, you know, CB, you had to answer the junkers' call whenever that sounded, and you got various jobs to do. We were very lenient, really, by the military police, or as it was regimental police, not military police, it was regimental police. But you had the various jobs to do. You were still had to do the same sort of punishment on a much lesser scale. So the leniency wasn't in the discipline, but in the award that was given to you.
You've mentioned the Junkers' Call there, Mr. Temple. What was the most common or favoured music for the regiment that you were playing?
Well, a lot of it was confined from the march point of view with the combined bugle and band. Mechanised infantry, light bark, the bugle of the regiment, whatever it happened to be. There were so many different types of marches. And I noted in looking in retrospect from now to then, we played very few American marches. We were all majority of British composers. And it rather surprised me that today when you hear music or martial music on the radio or television, a lot of American stuff is played rather than the British, like the voice of the guns and things like that. And it rather surprised me because there's a tremendous amount of British marches by wonderful composers. And consequently, you seem to favour these rather than the American ones. The Americans were a little bit more jazzy than what we were. We were strictly the military side. They would tend to go the other way. Like the Stars and Stripes, for instance. We never even... The bandmaster, Willie Woodbine, wouldn't even entertain that sort of thing. He liked the voice of the guns or the third DGs, whatever he decided on. And this was always decided by him and the band sergeant, of course. We had no say in the matter of the selection of music. But a lot of the music that we used to play, was a combination of band and bugles together. Like the buglers, mechanised infantry, some French and Belgian type of marches, which were not in their particular mode, but we converted them or transferred them into ours. So we had a variation, really, of mainly continental stuff and ours mixed together, and it gives us a fairly good repertoire.
Did you ever get the opportunity, as you went on, in this particular instance, of playing popular music of the day? Not so much in marching situation, but in leisure activity.
Yeah, you were required to do this because you weren't just a martial unit. Whilst you did this, you were practising really for the benefit of the regiment itself when you were on the commanding officer's parade or the adjutant's parade or the general's parade, whichever it was, and the band was always needed on those occasions. And as I said previously, if one of the companies had decided they were going to rehearse for something special, then the band would go and play the usual stuff for them. But other music, certainly, we used to play music from the operas and from the ballets. The musical compositions from Irving Berlin and that from Broadway. All those were combined to give us a programme of music. Waltzes from Strauss. The different types of music, even modern songs of that time, transport for the military band use. And even Geordie songs, which we used to the keel row, as I said, was one of them. And how we keep your feet still, Geordie, Henny. We used to play that sort of stuff. And we also, the band isn't only there to play for the regiment or for the officers, which happened once a week, incidentally, the officers' mess call. We always used to play for there for about 2 to 3 hours sometimes, depending on how long the event went on. But that happened every Thursday night, and you had to be there, all fully dressed, fully cared out. But you also went on engagements to various places. You played in tattoos, like the Aldershot Tattoos, which were one of the things that they used to get, the wonderful things for the Royal Tournament. And we used to come back up north to do tattoos up here, the South Shields Tattoo. It was one that we always used to go visit various places. You went different parts of the country. In effect, whilst we were an integral part of the regiment, allowances, freeway allowances, really had to be made so that the band were enabled to accept these engagements at various parts of the country with the permission, of course, of the commanding officer. But we used to travel all over the country and doing these engagements. And sometimes you could be away for a fortnight at a time. And incidentally, we were always known as the gentlemen of the regiment, who always seemed to get the best. But we didn't have our own transport. Whenever we had to go, Yeah, we order request buses. And of course, they were paid for this. The engagement fee went to the regiment, but it was divided between what we called the band fund. There was a certain percentage went to the band fund. And after the battalion had got a certain amount of money from it, the rest were then split up into various shares that the bandmaster, band sergeant, band corporal, and lance corporals, and this, to the last one of the board, which probably get the tail end of it, and they were all given shares. It was equally shared out. To their way of thinking, it was equally shared out, but to our way of thinking, it was the boy, especially, who was at the tagged bobtail at the back. He was getting almost cut-alls for playing maybe a fortnight's music. But it worked out well. It also helped to subsidise the purchase of musical instruments, which we didn't always rely on the army to do this. They didn't for mine, for instance. They had no instrument for me when I'd first joined the band. And Willie Woodbine, the bandmaster, had said, well, we'll have to pay for that. But he got it out of the band fund. And we also had a band president. He was always engaged in one of the offices of the regiment. And he was the boss that we had to go to for this money. We couldn't just spend it willy-nilly. And a lot of the music was also purchased by the band fund. The regiment, we didn't rely on a lot for funds. As I say, this money that we got in from various engagements always showed to us well that we could always replace instruments and purchase new music, of which we had when we went on engagement anyway, the amount of music we had was terrific. Huge boxes of music, all neatly parceled up in the various titles. And we used to rehearse a programme, say, for South Shields, maybe in the park. Because when we used to come up here to do the tattoo, the South Shields tattoo, we would also take other engagements, like playing at Gateshead, Chesley Street, Durham, South Shields, Sunderland. And we also had a programme for all of these. So you carried a fair amount of music with you, always in boxes, huge boxes. And this was always carefully packed. And before every performance, we used to rehearse every performance, of course. If we were going, say, to Shields Park or the Shields... We had a bandstand on the seafront where we used to play quite frequently. You would rehearse that programme. And on the day that you were going there, suppose it was in the afternoon, you would all parade about 11 o'clock in the morning. You wouldn't parade. You would report to wherever you were at the time, in some sort of barracks or wherever, or some school where we were billeted. You would have to report at that particular time at 11 o'clock, and then you would have to start shortening music on. And that was done on an organised basis. Because there had been mistakes made where we've gone through there and we hadn't got this new piece of music or that piece of music. Now, this was the responsibility of the bandmaster, the band sergeant. He'd have the programme and then he'd dish all the music out from the box and say, right, this is the programme for today. And we would go through each piece of music individually and he'd call the name out of each piece of music, and anybody with a player who played any instrument didn't have that. Then if that was checked through, wondered where it was, then we'd find it and put it in. But there were very few mistakes. It was so methodical, done by Dougie Bonham. He was very, very strict on that. That music had to be... And, of course, it was our responsibility as a musician to pick that music up at the end of the day, because we used to read a piece of music and then turn it face down on the next page and carry on. So it never really lost its position in its pile. And at the end of the day, the end of the programme, that was taken back with you to wherever we were billeted, and that was handed back in and put back in its section of the box. So there was very few mistakes ever made on the lack of music. Like on the concert I recently attended where they were scheduled to play the programme, this piece of music, and it wasn't there, they'd forgotten it. It very rarely happened, not with Dougie Bonham. He was so strict with his music. And it was, we used to enjoy these things, but as I say, the end product was that we didn't rely so much on the army for finances or the regiment for finances. It nearly all came from the band fund. So to a great degree, we were self-supporting as well. We were assisting the government, as it were, to replace our own instruments.
You've mentioned various NCOs in the band. And you mentioned the band president as being an officer. Do you recall the officer who was in Black Down?
When we were in Black Down, it was then, I think it was... Major Heslop. It was always either captain or a major of that, never of course the colonel, although he had to be consulted in everything that the band done, invariably by the bandmaster and the band president, and then they would approach the commanding officer, and we always had to have his consent for everything. He was the overall man who said yea or nay. We would put the ideas forward, the bandmaster and the band president, to the commanding officer, and they would agree amongst them three cells. So whilst we were, as an individual unit, you might say, in the regiment, with nobody else interfered with, we still had this overall supervision from the top, so that we just couldn't do anything we wanted. I mean, the bandmaster, for instance, couldn't receive a letter from any organisation and say, yes, we'll go there. That was out of the question. That was never done. He would consult with the band president, and then we'd go to the commanding officer, and he would give the ultimate decision. He would make that decision, not us.
Who was commanding officer?
Gray Wilson was the commanding officer at the time. We didn't take him abroad with us. We went abroad. Major Heslop, as a matter of fact, he took us abroad to Shanghai. He's a wonderful chap, really, but he used to take a keen interest in the band, in the sense that they were good sportsmen, especially with hockey and cricket. Practically the whole of the regimental hockey team came from the band, with the exception of about three or four. Consequently, we were also told that, well, if you're going to be a musician, you've also got to be a hockey player, sort of a semi-condition that they laid down. But Major Heslop did take a lot of interest in it, and he would often come when he had nothing else to do. He was second in command of the regiment, of course, he always had a lot to do, but he always used to make time to visit the band at least once a week and have a chat to the fellows before we started band practice. And then you maybe stay a quarter of an hour just chatting to the bandmaster and chatting to some of the lads.
Were there any ceremonies over the year that were special for the band and the regiment? I'm thinking of possibly ceremonies commemorating a battle honour or a battle occasion or a historical occasion.
Not really, Harry. We used to do a ceremony, I think it was about once a week, which was beating retreat, where you would spend half an hour on that, or maybe an hour on that. It was all rehearsed. This was surely purely simply by the band. We would do it on the square. And it was notified, all the regiment, the companies were notified that this was happening. It was always a spectacle that was worth seeing, because it was really worthwhile. The colours, of course, were there's another parade, but this was usually taken by the commanding officer, the presentation of the colours to the men, the slow time. Much as you see the changing of the trooping of the colour, for instance, which was you see every year on the Queen's birthday. We used to do a similar sort of ceremony with that in the regiment. And the locals round the area where we were at the time were all notified of this so that they could come onto the square, because there wasn't the security in those days, what there is now. They could all come in. And we used to get quite good audiences coming from as far as field as, when we were in Blackdown, coming from as far as field as walking from Guildford to see the ceremony of the colours and then the beating of retreat. So we used to do fairly well. It was always a ceremony, and commanding officer's parade, of course, was one of the big highlights. He was the guy who used to hold this parade where the whole battalion was on, from the lowest junior to the from boy, you know, to the highest rank. And this commanding officer's parade, he used to take a burst, not frequently, but whenever it was, you had to be top notch for that one. The only one above that was when the GOC came round. You had to have the band present there. And that had to be right on the top line when the GOC came round. And the other one that used to be at top line was not a performance so much for the military or the civilians, but when the inspector of Nella Hall used to visit the band. You were visited once every year to make sure that the bandmaster was doing, and the band sergeant, the NCOs in the band were doing the stuff. And he used to come, he used to spend 3 days with us. And they used to send a test piece of music from Nella Hall, and he used to bring it with him. And you got half an hour to practice that. And he would go away for half an hour, probably to the officer's mess or whatever sergeant's mess, whatever rank he was at the time. And he'd come back and say, right, oh, we'll start on this test piece. And it had to be pretty good. And he used to, whenever he made a report, of course, we always got a copy of it. It was always sent back to us with a copy. And then the bandmaster could either comment on one way or the other. They were never feared, because I think they were always fair, but they were strict in the sense that they were going to make sure that the money that they were spending, the government was spending, was being well done to. We always used to get a good report. Purely and simply, the best reports that we ever got was used to be our dance band. We had a terrific dance band, about a 14-piece dance band, with the lads who really got themselves together. Now, they used to take engagement separately from the military band. They would play at officers' balls. Sergeant mess dances and things like that. Or some country club will have it. Can we have the band? Again, with the commanding officer's permission, they would apply to the commanding officer, and we said, oh, we've got a job on here with a dance band. And they made quite a name for themselves. And whenever the inspector came from Nella Hall, he used to be amazed at the dance band. Because we had one fella who was, I don't know why he joined the army, Bill Donoghue. I think he must have been a bit of a mobster somewhere in London. He got it in trouble, but he was one good piano player. And he'd obviously had experience in playing in dance bands, which he was passing on to us. And the inspector from Nella Hall couldn't believe it at times when he used to hear the stuff being played. From the Louis Armstrong stuff, because we had a good trumpeter, Charlie Gower. He was good. He was first cornet, but he was also first trumpet. And they used to earn themselves quite a bit of money for that. But again, so far as the money's concerned, so much to the band fund, so much, and so it went on and on. And I didn't get the chance for that, by the way. Not me, I was too young for that. I wasn't experienced enough anyway. And it was, we always used to, the Nella Hall inspection, we used to look forward to with a bit of trepidation, because he was strict. He would listen to this test piece, and then we'd also listen to other pieces that we'd arrange a programme for him. And then he would say, right, what do you like on marching? Then we would go up in the square and do some counter marching for him, playing at the normal pace of the regiment. And then he would say, spend about 3 days with it. He would say, get the boys together, and he'd test them on their knowledge. And then testing us on our knowledge, he was also testing the bandmaster and the band sergeant, who were responsible for tutoring us. And we, as I say, Harry, we used to get a fairly good report, because Willie Woodbine and Dougie Bolan were strict. They made sure this 7 o'clock business, when we used to finish, the first hour or so was on the rudiments of music, the really basic. They never let you ever forget the rudiments of music, because as I firmly believe that this was the right sort of program to do. You went through that, and you went on your scales, doing your arpeggios and all sorts of practices before they would even let you go onto a piece of music, and they would just dish a piece of music each and say, here, play that. Private practice again, you know, in what we call individual practice. Again, a cacophony of sound, but it was thorough good training. But the inspector from Nella Hall always questioned the boys mainly on the rudiments of music and what they were doing over the period of the year. And the report was always sent back to us, or to the colonel of the regiment, to the commander. And he used to just pass it on to the band sergeant and make his comments on the report. But we always seemed to get a good report. We had a good band. In fact, a lot of our lads, before we went abroad, some of them, I think, didn't like the idea of going abroad. Tim Scully, Ginger Ward, Spike Malcolm. They said, oh, well, I'm going to get out of this. So the two of them transferred to the lifeguards. The other one transferred to the horse guards before we ever went. But they missed a joy when they missed going abroad with us. But this usually happened where you got good musicians. These big staff bands that we used to call them, like the Royal Artillery Staff Band, the Ordnance Corps Staff Band, the Service Corps Staff Band, the Lifeguards, the Coldstreams. They hear about a good musician that we have, and they would try to poach him, you know. And we used to lose quite a number of good musicians from that. So it was always a constant battle with the bandmaster to try to keep that standard that we'd always been maintained. Always a battle. We succeeded.
Did you have any other duties at any time outside of your musical duties as boys?
Not really, Harry. We had no duties in that respect. This was one of, well, bandsmen generally had no duties outside, other than I'm saying that in the event of war, of course, we were as stretcher bearers, which I've also previously mentioned. We also had this instruction on stretcher bearing and all the. In fact, there was competitions throughout the whole of the Southern Command, and we won that quite frequently, stretcher drill. We were taught this at the elementary stage as a boy, but then we would gradually progress until you got into the team, the first team, just like first division, second division, third division football, you know, we would gradually approach that.
And what kind of training did that take?
Well, this is first aid training in the main. This was done by the Royal Army Medical Corps. They would come along and give us lectures on the basics of first aid. And some of it was elementary to what they get now. I mean, it was nothing then, you know, the usual fractures and things, bleeding, which was, of course, in the case of battle, you wouldn't have to know how to stop bleeding. The systemic system, the circulatory system, all elementary stuff to them. Well, it wasn't to us, of course. And they used to do this, and they would teach us the stretcher drill, and it was carried out as a drill, purely and simply because if it was instilled in you, much as the same as discipline is, what you would do to a wounded person, and if you worked that as they used to instruct as a drill, you would do that automatically, and you were always doing it the right way. That was why it was done, not because it was army business, because they knew you were going to have to do it the right way. And you would always do it the right way if it was taught to you. But that was about the only thing that we used to do outside of normal band training. Sports, I said, the boys always were compelled to take part in boxing. And this used to be individual boxing between the boys of the battalion, or the battalion next door, and if you had some good enough stuff, of course, which we had at the time, we had Norman Gare and a lad called Napton, went in for the Aldershot Command Championship, which Napton won. And I didn't like it very much, because I was at the thick end of a thick ear. I was always at the wrong end of it, as it were. And I was very pleased when we got there, when Willie Woodbine left us, and a bandmaster called Rippon came and took over, direct from the Nella Hall. And he came at the time when we were rehearsing or practicing these boxing things in the gymnasium. He said, "Oh, this has got to stop." And he told the commanding officer so. And he said, "Well, why?" He said, "Well, I don't want my musicians' hands damaged, or I don't want their teeth damaged. Band goes the reputation of the Durham Light Infantry Band. If a corner player gets his teeth smashed in, I'm sorry, but you've no longer got a bandsman." It never happened, but he put this excuse forward, and he had my blessings for doing it, because I've got many hiding in the boxing ring.